Okay, let's see how many go. Oh, 328. Okay, let's go. Time to start.
Excellent.
What accent is that? Good question. That is a British accent. You successfully defeated us in 1776. Congratulations. But now we have more important enemies to defeat, the big tech platforms. What a couple of days, Darren. We've been talking about tech censorship for the past couple of weeks. I've written a whole book about it. You can find it at deletedbook.com. You and I think, have both been warning about this problem, and many people on the right have been warning about the growing power of Silicon Valley for 4 or 5 years now, and I think people have finally woken up to it. I mean, establishment, I mean, no disrespect to the New York Post. The New York Post is fantastic. They have some fantastic people working for them. This story they broke is truly incredible, and you should follow the reporter who published all the stories, Emma Jo Morris. I think it's at Emma Jo NYC on Twitter. She's fantastic. Make sure you follow her. But I feel like the censorship of the New York Post has a kind of silver lining, because it's really woken up so many people. It's like a Rubicon has been crossed. They've finally gone too far. Now the FCC is taking action. I mean, for 5 years, we've seen people on the so-called fringe right getting suspended from these platforms, and people just ignored it. Well, they're too inconvenient to defend. We can't defend Alex Jones. We can't defend the Proud Boys. Right. We can't defend any of these people. We can't even, you know, disagree with their views, but defend their free speech rights. It's something that people just completely ignored, but it's just escalated and escalated and escalated. And now it's come for a newspaper founded by Alexander Hamilton. It's come for the White House press secretary. It's coming for everyone. That's where we are today. Now, Darren, your thoughts on the past few days? I've spoken enough.
Well, absolutely. You're absolutely right. As I was saying, this is Alim Bakari's world now. Everything you've been warning about is coming to fruition in a very dramatic way. And yes, you know, this latest censorship fiasco of the New York Post article is of a different character, not only in its type, but also in its magnitude, in the sense that, as you say, you know, a lot of people in the so-called fringe have been censored, and that established a precedent for censorship. I don't think it should have happened, but a lot of these coward conservatives, they don't care about the precedent. They just wanted to be respectable. And now you have a case, and again, the New York Post story is an explosive story, but it's actually a very kind of, it's a story that appeals to normal conservatives in an election year. It doesn't involve any of the kind of the more sensitive topics about, you know, race or gender or, you know, weird conspiracy theories, nothing like that. It's almost like tailor-made to tap the hornet's nest of just mainstream conservatism at, you know, just weeks before an election. And so it's really interesting. And the FCC action of Pi, that gives me some degree of optimism. We'll have to see how it actually plays out, but we're certainly at a period of equilibration. There's simply no hiding behind illusions anymore. That either means we're equilibrating to a completely kind of overt totalitarian system where, you know, the left doesn't even need to pretend like we're a free society anymore, and they just get away with it. It could mean that, or it could mean that they just kind of, they went a little bit too much and too soon, and that this was actually a dramatic miscalculation on their part, and they failed basically on two dimensions. They weren't able to effectively suppress the story. In fact, they amplified it dramatically.
I'll just interrupt you briefly there. That's an important point, because it doesn't happen every time. Some people assume it happens every time there's a Streisand effect. That's the sociological term, I guess, for when you try and censor a story, you try and censor information, and the result is that the information spreads more widely. That actually doesn't happen all the time. Lots of small people get censored. No one notices that it happens so often, and many of the people getting censored don't have a large media presence. This time they tried to do it to the New York Post. Big mistake. They ended up amplifying the story. But sorry, NW, go on.
Yeah, and so it's really, you know, that you could say that they turned up the heat a little bit too much, and the, you know, proverbial slow boiling frog jumped out of the pan, and now the frogs are angry, to extend the metaphor. That's sort of the optimistic take, and I think there is a certain element of truth to that. But you know, the other side is simply that people's attention spans are so short, and that even an outrage as big as this is quickly forgotten. And even as the entire political world was kind of seized with this profound outrage, what happened right under our noses, that probably much fewer the audience knows about, is that the entire, you know, YouTube just nuked the accounts of just about every QAnon aligned channel, mounting to millions and millions of subscribers. And the pretext is actually very interesting. The pretext isn't like there's no official group called QAnon. It's a vague term, and basically they formulated such that they had very broad discretion as to who they can censor. Effectively,
yeah, good point from Michael. By the way, there are many angry frogs at the moment.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. They're getting away with so much under the radar. The other day, completely missed by most people because of everything that was going on with the New York Post and, you know, the White House press secretary getting censored, the Trump campaign kind of getting censored as well. Facebook deleted the page of an entire political party in New Zealand just a few weeks before their elections. And you know, their excuse, well, you know, this party is run by conspiracy theorists. That doesn't matter. It's up to the voters. Facebook can't just intervene in a democratic election a few weeks before the vote. Doesn't matter how crazy the candidates are. And you touched on an interesting point earlier, by the way, which is that, you know, in the past, many of the incidents of censorship related to issues of gender and race or conspiracy theories or other things that, you know, people felt icky about, they didn't want to, you know, get involved in. And that's wrong, by the way. It used to be perfectly normal for people to say, look, I disagree with what someone is saying, you know, I'm not in full agreement with them, but I'm going to defend their right to say it. People don't say that anymore, except on the right. And even on the right, you know, establishment conservatives wouldn't come out and, you know, say those very basic words, I disagree with what they say, but they shouldn't be banned from social media. It was so difficult for senators and congressmen and all think tanks, anyone else you can name in the Republican establishment, to make that simple argument. So their failure led to the current situation where we have the New York Post getting censored, the White House press secretary, and the Trump campaign. They got us where we are then, finally taking action. The question is, will it be enough? Is it too late? We're only 2 weeks away from the election. Big tech putting their thumb on the scale for the past 4 years.
Right.
And honestly, Dan, I got to tell you, if Trump loses on November the 3rd, obviously, you know, you and I both hope he doesn't. But if he does, big tech manipulation will be a big part of the reason. Google adjusting their search results to make sure undecided voters never see a conservative article, adjusting their YouTube results to make sure that pro-life videos never show up in searches for abortion, or conservative and libertarian videos never show up in searches for the Federal Reserve. We actually proved they did that on Breitbart News. We leaked their search blacklist. Twitter suspending every dissident conservative, Facebook doing the same. That'll be a huge part of it. Their suppression of what was an extremely powerful online grassroots movement, perhaps the most powerful one in history. They completely killed that over 4 years. And I think if Trump loses, that'll be a big part of the reason why. What can we do to fight them? American Thar asks. That's a good question. What do you think about that, Dan? What can we do to fight them?
Well, there are short, medium, and long-term solutions. I mean, I think in the short term, we need to, you know, the DOJ, FEC need to be activated immediately. And there needs to be a threat of criminal charges when it comes to election interference of such an egregious type on the part of these big tech firms. I think in the medium term, short to medium term, there needs to be serious Section 230 action. And so that's why I'm encouraged by Ajit Pai's announcement. And it's all the more reason that we need to absolutely insist on an expedited confirmation of FCC chairman nominee Nathan Symington. In the longer
update on that, I'll just interrupt with an update on that. The Commerce Committee has noticed the hearing. Do you know what date they picked? Let me find it. They have announced a hearing for Nathan Symington.
I will after the election.
After the election, yes, you're correct. More than a day after the election, Tuesday, November 10th, 2020.
Well, that's
so. Not in time for the FCC to do anything about big tech censorship, although they really should have started doing something about it 4 years ago, not 3 weeks away from the election. And the same goes for Republicans. I don't want to guess all Republicans. Some have been very vocal on this. They have moved the issue forward. Cruz, Hawley, Loeffler, all these people, Gosar especially. Gosar has some very interesting proposals. He has a bipartisan bill with Tulsi Gabbard at the moment, which I think hits on the some very interesting points, especially giving users an opt-out of some of these big tech algorithms. I think that's crucial. Gosar might just be the best congressman in the House. I'm not, I won't say that decisively, but he's certainly one of the best, if not the best.
Gates is very good.
Gates is excellent. There are some Republicans who are good, but they've just sat on their hands for so long. And I'll tell you what, the Supreme Court hearings this past week, first point to make, you know, people who are predicting a second Kavanaugh are completely wrong. They have nothing on Amy Coney Barrett. She's has a spotless record as far as I can tell. But the questions the senators are asking Amy Coney Barrett, you know, the questions that have been asked for three decades, you know, what's your stance on Roe versus Wade? What's your stance on gay marriage? All very important questions, I'm sure. But the most important question that can be asked right now to a potential Supreme Court justice is, what's your stance on Section 230? What do you think about the tech giants? What do you think about their impact on the First Amendment? Those are the questions that should be asked. Those are the questions that are relevant to the moment. The fact that lawmakers are not asking those kinds of questions suggests to me they haven't really understood the magnitude of the problem.
Well, there's a broader issue with that. And this gets to kind of, you know, all of the standard questions that have been asked basically since, you know, since the 80s, since the Reagan era, when there was a kind of established judicial philosophy of jurisprudence that was built into kind of the architecture of the Reagan movement and movement conservatism. And it was very well equipped to deal with the hot button culture war issues of the Reagan period that, you know, are still relevant today, the abortion, the homosexual issues, all and so forth. And but the architecture was not there to address these new threats that we face, including perhaps especially the threat from the concentrated private, technically private power of big tech. That's neither built into the architecture of conservative jurisprudence necessarily, hence the lack of questions that you drew attention to, but it's really more generally not built into the ideological architecture of conservatism. And so you still have these people who don't have the vocabulary and the concepts to deal with the fact that you have these huge corporations who control an overwhelming share of political discourse in the country and are censoring over half of the country in terms of where their opinions are. And the conservatives, a lot of them still, sadly, pathetically, don't have the vocabulary, or one might put it, don't have the software updates to effectively deal with this pressing issue.
Conservatives, establishment conservatives, I should say, are digging their own grave on this issue. All right. The issues they care about, whether it's abortion or gay marriage or anything you can think of, are sideshows compared to the big tech issues. They will not be allowed to discuss those issues. They won't be allowed to take their message to the American people. The big tech platforms won't allow their message to reach undecided voters if they don't resolve the big tech issue. So every other issue they care about, from abortion to gay marriage, to lower taxes, to the border even, are sideshows compared to this issue. They won't be allowed to talk about it. So it needs to be the number one priority for them. It needs to be the top question they ask a Supreme Court justice nominee.
I want to talk specifically about the pretext for censoring not only the New York Post article, but more general pretext that we see all over the place for censorship of mostly conservative positions. And that is this concept of disinformation. In fact, disinformation was the concept, the word of the year, 2019, is nominated by NPR. And there's a reason for that. If people go back to the early stages of the Trump years, the Trump presidency, people remember that the term fake news was originally invented to silence pro-Trump narratives. Trump very brilliantly and very effectively co-opted that term for his own purposes. The term disinformation is this new weaponized concept that's meant to function in the way that fake news originally intended. There are a couple things I'd like to say about disinformation. So you have people, I could read off the list, read off the tweets, people saying, this New York Post article is Russian disinformation, it's Putin propaganda, and so forth. And so this ties into this color revolution framework, and it ties into this general trend that I've identified in earlier talks of ours and elsewhere, that what you see is very disturbing development whereby broad swaths of our own national security apparatus are being repurposed to silence and suppress Trump supporters, general conservatives domestically. And part of the mechanism by which that's achieved is framing speech that they don't like as disinformation, which is an intelligence term. It's an intelligence term of craft meant to formulate the issue in national security terms. Now, the interesting thing about this is if you look at these conferences on disinformation, they're almost all sponsored by these completely malicious and fake Atlanticist groups like the Atlantic Council, NATO-aligned groups. NATO, by the way, is a very evil organization. People don't appreciate the role that they have played in the censorship of the internet, which is a story unto itself. That we can get into, but
let's touch on the Atlantic Council briefly, because many people don't know the Atlantic Council is officially partnered with Facebook to help promote free and fair elections around the world. Let me tell you guys a little bit about the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council, their advisory board includes Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton's former Secretary of State, James Clapper. I think most people will be familiar with James Clapper.
Right.
I believe Henry Kissinger as well. This is a neoconservative establishment Atlanticist think tank. They're all about promoting American influence around the world, whether it's by military means or non-military means. This is a neoconservative think tank. So I got to say, if the anti-war left believes these tech giants will never come from them, they've got another thing coming when Facebook is working directly with the Atlantic Council. And what a phrase. Promoting free and fair elections around the world.
Right.
When you hear a bunch of neoconservatives say they're going to come and make your elections freer and fairer, Iraqis will tell you, you've got to run the other way. By the way, guys, keep asking questions in the chat.
Let me finish this point about disinformation, though, because you have a bunch of people characterizing this New York Post piece as disinformation. So again, that's using the gravitas, imprimatur, and in many cases, the resources of the national security apparatus, reappropriating it to suppress political speech domestically. That's what the whole disinformation scam is meant to do. Another thing about disinformation, I've looked at a lot of these disinformation conferences, and one disturbing trend in this is that they count as disinformation, doesn't even have to come from a foreign source. They term as disinformation anything that in their perception aligns with the interests of a foreign power, even if it's domestic in origin. What that means is, for instance, take Russia, the favorite example. Now, Russia would probably in some ways benefit from an American geopolitical realignment toward concern with the rise of China. But by this definition of disinformation, because Russia might benefit from this pivot to Asia, that's in our benefit, I think, as well, anything advocating this geopolitical realignment would be considered ipso facto disinformation by this Atlantic Council group. And I think it's important to say this Atlantic Council, in some sense, it's neoconservative, but actually, I think we can refine it even further is to say that the Atlantic Council is an arm of NATO, and it represents a faction of the American ruling class that is still principally concerned with Europe and Russia. And where it's all coming from is this issue that Putin is able to maintain geopolitical leverage over Europe via gas politics. And what people don't know is that, you know, Gazprom is probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, gas energy company. And Putin uses it to great effect to assert his political influence in Europe and has actually used this influence to counteract successfully color revolution attempts by these Atlanticist groups.
Yeah, and Europeans know this very well.
And you know, what's interesting here to tie it together is that there was a certain group, there's a certain company that was kind of cultivated in order to be the US or NATO Atlanticist aligned counterweight to Gazprom. And that is none other than Burisma. So in fact, there's a whole puzzle here. And I'm going, if people aren't following revolver.news, you better do it, because there's going to be some absolutely explosive stuff coming out about the story of censorship of the internet, but also getting into energy politics and so forth. Revolver.news is so threatening to these color revolution professionals. We were actually featured in the New York Times the other day in a remarkable piece. I don't even remember the woman's name, but the piece was, it invoked this concept we've been talking about, disinformation. The First Amendment in the age of disinformation. Effectively, the argument was that we need to reinterpret the First Amendment so as to be able to censor articles like the Revolver.news article on Norm Eisen exposing the color revolution against Trump.
That's high praise to be singled out for censorship. I've read that New York Times article, by the way, and they're arguing for what they call a European model of free speech, which I thought was interesting terminology. Obviously, the European model of so-called free speech is to simply have government censor anything they want by calling it hate speech.
Right.
Or calling it, threatening to public order or public stability.
Right. That's the terminology. Really embarrassing. I would say at least treat us like adults and call it the Chinese model of speech. At least be a little bit more honest about it. And the final thing, there's so much to say, but the final point I really want to squeeze in about disinformation, this is really, really important, is by characterizing something as disinformation, they're able to skirt around the question that I would think is kind of important as to whether or not the claims are actually true. To call something disinformation and dismiss it as disinformation deliberately obfuscates the question as to whether it's true. It doesn't matter if it's true. They say, oh, this is Russia propaganda. This comes from Russia. Now, of course, that's ridiculous. But even if it did come from Russia, about the WikiLeaks stuff, even if it did come from Russia, which is ridiculous, if it's true, who cares? The term disinformation is meant not only to censor us, it's meant to rob the importance of whether something is true or not from our discourse. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. What matters is if it's aligned with narrative. And the concept disinformation perfectly encapsulates that. It's very dangerous, it's very Orwellian, and it's the new weapon that they use to shut you up.
It's misdirection, because in the debate, the debate becomes not about the story or the facts, but whether it's misinformation or not, whether it's hate speech or not, whether it's fake news, all these terms fulfill the same purpose.
You're so right. And look,
I'll tell you a quote from an insider at Facebook. I quoted this in the book, Deleted. Check out the link above. But what he told me was that the people who pushed for Facebook's efforts against misinformation, against fake news, against so-called polarization and to promote election integrity, this whole myriad of terms that emerged conveniently right after the 2016 election, The people who pushed for that were the most anti-Trump people at Facebook.
Of course.
And you look at the people who staff these initiatives now, the anti-misinformation experts at Facebook, they're all from the deep state. We exposed one of them at Breitbart a few months ago. She worked at the CIA for 10 years under John Brennan.
Right.
And she had a Black Lives Matter banner in her profile picture. So right. She was part of the woke left and she was part of the deep state.
They're one and the same. That's the thing. The deep state, the bureaucracy, the national security bureaucracy, and I think it's almost better to think of the left as an extension of the national security bureaucracy than the other way around, actually, at this point. And again, the crucial trend that people are seeing, the number one threat that we're seeing is the increasing weaponization of our national security apparatus and vocabulary in order to suppress domestic speech and the energies associated with the victory of Donald Trump. The whole national security apparatus is being marshaled against this. And this disinformation concept, which is a term of craft that comes from the information warfare offices of the CIA, of the State Department, and of their aligned NGOs associated with NATO, associated with the National Endowment for Democracy. All of these groups are very evil groups. They pose an extreme threat to the liberty of Americans. And again, we need to graduate from thinking of things simply in terms of left and right and confront the deeply disturbing reality that our own national security state has, for the most part, turned against the American people.
And big tech is the biggest weapon they've ever had. Keep in mind, these deep state guys, they work in intelligence. Imagine the KGB or the Stasi with the power of Facebook or Google, the power to know everything you're interested in. Everything you've ever read, every website you've ever browsed. This is an enormous amount of power. They know exactly who the undecided voters are. They know exactly who the conservatives are, who the liberals are. They can use that power to swing elections, and they are using the power to swing elections. They've cut off undecided voters from stories that challenge the narrative. That's what this New York Post story is about. Because the New York Post story was so viral, such a bombshell, they had to censor it completely to stop it getting out. With smaller stories, what they do is they simply make sure that no one sees it in their Google search results or no one sees it at the top of their Facebook feeds.
Right.
This is how it's a machine for manipulating people. It's a machine for putting their thumbs on the scale of elections. And it doesn't just have effectiveness here in America. This is the important thing to remember. Everywhere where Facebook and Google and these tech giants are dominant is an area where they can influence. The deep state is salivating at that kind of power. That's why the Atlantic Council is working with Facebook. Of course, they want the power to influence elections around the world. They've never had this kind of power before. So that's the situation we're dealing with. A handful of insane far-left people in the San Francisco Bay Area suddenly, very quickly over the past 5 years, have acquired the power to put their thumbs on the scales of elections all around the world. It's amazing how fast that happened. And it's digital totalitarianism. People need to learn about it. They need to read about it. And the big test will be this election. Can they get rid of Donald Trump? Are they that powerful? I certainly think if he loses, we got to start looking at big tech. That'll be the reason why. But it might already be too late by then.
Right. It's very disturbing, very true, and it's we're entering a very, very interesting stage of basically kind of global awareness, because again, I think we're at an equilibration point. I think we're moving from a persuasion model to a coercion model, at least to the degree that I think the corrupt ruling class has increasingly comfortable with dispensing with the illusions that once kind of governed the public justifications of their own institutions. Now they're willing to act overtly in a way that they hadn't before. And whichever way we go, we're equilibrating away from this illusion of the United States as this kind of free society, this free democracy, whatever it is, it's not that. It hasn't been for a long time, but I think now people are starting to realize it. And so that's why I really like your title, The Mask Off, because now in the era of COVID, which is this unprecedented consolidation of power, the standpoint of the ruling class, and masks are involved in this. So they make us all wear masks, but in this metaphorical sense, the mask is slipping insofar as the nature of the society that we live in, the nature of our country and its true power structure and how it's really governed. As you pointed out, we're in an oligarchy, and that's becoming undeniably clear. And so there's a certain clarity that we gain even as we move to this kind of new phase, and perhaps like very dangerous and even dystopian phase, but this new phase in our politics that we all need to learn how to navigate.
So many people in the chat are saying dismantle big tech, break up big tech. And I certainly understand that instinct. I want to get to some of the comments in the chat, but many people have said this. I very much understand that instinct. But the thing you have to remember is that these tech platforms, as they were initially conceived, were actually a huge benefit for conservatives, for people who wanted to challenge the narrative. They allowed you to get the message out there around the mainstream media. They allowed truly organic political movements to emerge, which was extremely threatening to the political establishment, to the foreign policy establishment. They suddenly couldn't control politics anymore. And that's why these tech platforms have had to be brought under the control of the establishment. The potential for new movements to emerge outside of the mainstream media, outside of the mainstream narrative, was so threatening to these people. So we don't want to destroy the big tech platforms. We want to get them back to where they were in 2015, when the populist movement was allowed to emerge, before they understood the power of the tech platforms and got them under control. That's what we want. We want to go back to that period. And the question is, what kind of policies can the base demand that would get us there? I've always thought, the key is to simply give users an opt-out of all these content filters. So if you're going to make any filter on legal speech as a tech platform, you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that users have opted in to that filter. And if you can't prove that, then you're not a platform and you're going to be liable for defamation lawsuits and your entire business model will go out the window. That's the solution I favor. Other solutions have been proposed. What are your thoughts on that, Darren?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think there's another kind of corollary there that's important to tease out, especially in light of the past couple of days. Now, I don't think these positions are mutually exclusive. There's one position that says, well, they're censoring so aggressively because the election's so close and they're trying to tip the scales, they're trying to rig it. I think that's absolutely true. There's a lot of truth to that. There's a different perspective, though, that I think also has some truth, and that is this is less an issue of rigging and more an issue of hedging. That is to say that they might expect that Biden will become the president, and they are kind of ingratiating themselves to future President Biden so he doesn't unleash in his senility and senescence, he doesn't unleash the Warren wing of the party, which terrifies them. In fact, the reality is, and you know this better than anyone, the only political faction that actually scares these tech firms is the Warren left. The Trump.
100% true. I've spoken to a few people in Silicon Valley, VCs, venture capitalists, and they're all terrified by Warren.
Quick on this point is that, unfortunately, I'd love for this to change. I think it can change, but the Trump administration is, to them, they consider it a joke, and they can't level any credible threats. They don't take them seriously at all. That's why they censor with impunity. And so far, he hasn't proved them wrong. I hope he will step up and prove them wrong. But so far, the only political faction that they're actually scared of is the Elizabeth Warren left. And the instrument associated with the Elizabeth Warren left, the stick, as it were, is the antitrust weapon. Now, I think that actually there is some validity to the general kind of Elizabeth Warren-esque critique of concentrated power that exists beyond specifically the censorship issue. I think there could be some case for breaking up any kind of conglomerate simply for sort of the negative externalities of such concentrated power on, you know, competition and creativity, and this idea that so many tech companies simply exist in order to be gobbled up by Google, and that's the effect of, you know, what the de facto monopoly power. But if you're focused specifically on censorship, I'm not terribly convinced. This is basically agreeing with you. I'm not terribly convinced that antitrust is the right approach. It can be a good kind of leverage tool. It can be a good threat if it's credible. But breaking up a big a conglomerate into multiple little ones, you know, if the little ones have the same culture of censorship, it's not really going to help anybody. And so,
antitrust is a threat. It's right. Like you said, it's a stick to beat the tech companies right. with. And the question is, what do you want them to do? Right. So Jonathan Jansen asks, you know, what if the Democrats get the presidency and the Congress? So this is what they'll do. They'll use antitrust and other forms of executive regulation as a stick to get the tech companies to do what they want them to do. And what they want is more censorship.
Exactly.
So antitrust as a weapon is, you know, potentially a positive tool in the right hands if you can get them to censor less. But if you're a Democrat wielding that power, they're going to censor even more.
Right. This is the funny thing. And this is the double-edged sword of any leverage point, including 230, is that both, you know, 230 and antitrust are in a way that, you know, they could be used as leverage tools. But the leverage tool is going to be more valuable to the side of the issue that can have more credible threats to use them. And so far, the left, you know, given the leverage tools on the table, the left and specifically the Elizabeth Warren left has been able to use the leverage tools more effectively. And so far, there's, you know, this danger that these points of leverage, even 230, I've seen used as a kind of threat tool by the left in order to force these companies to censor more, antitrust more so. And so we really need to kind of get into a position where our side is able to make credible threats so as to make effective use of these leverage tools. Otherwise, the other side is going to use them and make the situation even worse.
And that is now starting. This is why there is a silver lining. As I said at the start of this stream, there's a silver lining to the New York Post censorship because the FCC is now taking action. Jack Dorsey's getting subpoenaed. The Commerce Committee has finally, I don't think it's coincidence, announced today they're going to hold a hearing for Nathan Symington. If Trump is elected, these will give him the tools he needs to fight the tech censors. So internet freedom is on the ballot this November. Probably the most momentous question, I think, that has faced the American electorate.
It gives him the tools, but he has to use the tools.
He has to use the tools. He didn't for the last 4 years, but you know, the deep state sabotaged him. It was a complicated business. Establishment Republicans sabotaged him. The Senate wasn't very helpful. They didn't care about the issue. So I'm understanding why it took this long to get started, but I certainly do. I do see some hope in a second term Trump if he gets there. That's the question. Will big tech steal the election? The thesis of my book, by the way, is that they will steal the election. They've been doing it for 4 years. These are the most powerful communications technologies ever devised. Sources in Facebook and Twitter and Google say they've been doing this for 4 years. In fact, they're so alarmed by the threat to democracy that they put their careers on the line to come forward and warn the American public about this. So I don't think it's looking good from that perspective, but this will be the test. Can big tech swing an election? We'll find out in November.
Phil, I think the most dramatic video is the one that you released years ago of the Google C-suite reacting the day after the 2016 election and basically making an agreement in the midst of their kind of their hug session. They're so traumatized, they had a literal hug session, the C-suite of Google. It's a remarkable video. If anyone hasn't seen it, you have to see it. It's really terrifying, but also pathetic. And, you know, they all just made a pact. We are never going to let this happen again. We're never going to allow the American people to meddle in their own elections again. And shame on us for having our tool that used to allow free speech online. Shame on us for allowing these deplorable Trump supporters to use this great free and open internet for which we provide the infrastructure to allow Donald Trump to win. We're never going to allow that to happen again. And it seems like, to the greatest extent possible, they've made good on that promise. They've done everything they can to make good on that promise.
Completely true. And this is exactly what my sources in Twitter and Facebook say as well. There's a whole chapter in the book on this. And those companies are exactly the same. Total dismay. How did we let this happen? We can't let it happen again. That's been the mentality of Silicon Valley since Trump's election, with the assistance of the political establishment and the media elite, who have always been pressuring them to go even further. And when they don't play ball, they get the ad boycott. YouTube got the ad boycott. Right. Facebook got the ad boycott. That's how it works. Someone in the chat says they worked for Google. That's very interesting. Please email me about that. Go on my Twitter. My email address is in the bio. Always looking for new sources, current or former, who are willing to talk about these tech companies. I think we'll wrap up shortly, but I'm going to see if there are any good questions we can get to. I want to get through everyone, because there are a lot of comments. Lots of people talking about treason. It's correct. This is a digital coup. It's the Darren, you know this better than I. It's the alliance of the deep state and the tech giants that is so dangerous. You mentioned they're pathetic people. They are pathetic people. They all believe in completely nonsense theories like critical race theory and far left feminism, but they also happen to be in control of the most powerful communications platforms ever created. That's a very dangerous situation to be in. Morons in charge of extremely powerful weapons. That's what you don't want to happen in ever. And it's going to affect not just democracy in America, but all around the world. We are living in the Matrix. Correct. More people need to take the red pill. What role does China play in this? Jimmy Do Good asks. That's an interesting question. I think China is a little bit, I think you and I agree on this, Darren. China is a very convenient issue for establishment Republicans to talk about, because they can condemn censorship, they can be pro-free speech, but they don't need to defend any of the inconvenient extremist right-wingers or conspiracy theorists here in America.
And in some ways, just to push this, you know, to be deliberately provocative, but I think for a purpose, some degree it's even been counterproductive, because you have, I think you know about this, you've written about this, and it's, you know, it's companies like Google in this 5G battle have used the pretense of the threat of China in order to try to convince the Defense Department to free up, you know, to free up spectrum and other resources to give to Google to further empower Google. And they use the threat of China as this excuse to basically, release these resources to them. On the issue of TikTok, again, the China thing came up, and it's not, you know, it's fine what we did to TikTok, but the China issue as a matter of priority, you know, we've been much better off going after Google or Facebook or Twitter than TikTok. But yet the prominence of this, you know, this China threat narrative that, you know, makes us go after TikTok first is, again, a little bit counterproductive in terms of actual priority. So it served as a real kind of deflection mechanism for the people who are supposed to be fighting for us, who are supposed to be going after our big tech firms who are responsible for censoring us, to point the finger at China and basically serve as an excuse not to do anything. I wonder, just as like a hypothetical, I know what I would do if I were China is I would, you know, play the same game. If I were China, I would say, China refuses to do business with any major American tech firm that censors its own citizens. We absolutely refuse to do business with any U.S. tech company that censors its own citizens. And, you know, maybe eventually they'll get smart and start playing that game and take advantage of the fact that that our own tech companies are just about as censorious as theirs are. And I think even from
you almost want them to. That would teach the foreign policy a thing or two about
it's important to say is that this is not, I am not pro-China. This is about this is about deflecting the problems here, deflecting the problem of us becoming more like China by pointing to China. And I think, in fact, for the people who actually do care about winning the 5G race with China, that is, you know, a huge issue in terms of who's going to run the 21st century. The messaging has to be to make as clear a distinction between our internet, so to speak, and the Chinese internet. And if we become just another totalitarian internet, the way that China's is, we lose that information battle. We lose that information narrative weapon that could distinguish us from China and ultimately be used to win the 5G war. So there's simply no dimension on which it makes sense to allow our internet and our country from a free speech perspective to become more like China. And before we point fingers at what China's doing, censoring the Hong Kong,
I think we lost Darren there. Well, to continue that point, PJ Ayer notes the China social credit system. And I'm going to leave you guys with this before we close the Periscope. Over the past couple of days, you know, we've seen censorship affect the New York Post, the White House press secretary, the Trump campaign itself. So these are all very high-profile incidents of censorship that everyone saw. But that's just these high-profile incidents of censorship. They've happened to a lot of prominent conservatives. They're just the tip of the iceberg. People don't think we have a social credit system. We do have a social credit system. Silicon Valley has built one. It's just more decentralized. We have Darren back. I'm just explaining Silicon Valley's social credit system. You dropped for a second. So here's the way Silicon Valley's social credit system works. Everything you post online, whether you're creating a website and trying to get it on the front page of Google, whether you're creating a Twitter account, trying to make posts, YouTube account, Facebook account, they all work in a very similar way. Everything you post is given a numerical value by the tech giants. That numerical value is used by the algorithm to determine whether you're going to be on the first page of Google or the 100th. Whether you're going to be at the top of people's Facebook feeds or buried where no one can find them. And it used to be the case that the things that would determine your numerical value, which you can't see, by the way, they're not transparent about this, is things like, you know, are you posting links to websites with malware, with viruses, with spam, with illegal content, with unsafe content? That would lower your score, and that's pretty reasonable. But obviously today, the criteria they use is, are you posting misinformation? Are you posting hate speech? Are you posting fake news? Do you follow accounts that are known for doing those things? Those are the things that'll lower your score. So Silicon Valley's social credit score, much like China's social credit score, is now determined by how well you conform to the ruling elite's values. People say that, you know, we're so different from China, we're a liberal democracy. No, the private sector is building the exact same system. And unless American politicians get a hold on it, we will become China. It will be a thing. China's not good. We don't want to become China. But before we start, you know, trying to fix China in China, we've got to try and fix the growth of China-style policies in the U.S.
There is one important difference between the censorship in China and the censorship in the United States and the West. And it is this, that China censors political expressions that vitiate the pride of China and the Chinese people, whereas in the U.S., they censor expressions that celebrate the pride of America and American people. So in a way, our censorship is even more malicious and perverse than China's.
It's certainly very strange. They're trying to criminalize national pride. It's a very, very strange phenomenon, right. This pathological guilt. It's a very Western thing. I don't think other societies have it. But anyway.
It's unique.
Very unique. Someone should write a book about that. But anyway, we'll leave it there. We're on 51 minutes now. Fascinating discussion. We're gonna find out in a few weeks just how powerful these tech sensors are. I hope, and you know, on election night, we should do it on one of these periscopes.
Absolutely, absolutely. To be continued.
Okay, thanks for everyone's questions. They were great. And person who worked for Google, please get in touch. You'll find my email in my Twitter profile.